Dr. A. E. Wilder Smith studied natural sciences at the Oxford University and received his first doctorate in organic chemistry. During World War II, he did cancer research at the University of London and was elected a fellow in the Royal Institute of Chemistry. Later, he became director of research at a pharmaceutical firm in Switzerland and taught chemotherapy and pharmacology at the University of Geneva, where he received his second doctorate in pharmacology. Shortly after, he earned an additional doctorate from ETH in Zurich, which is equivalent to the MIT in our country. From 1964 to 1969, he taught pharmacology at the University of Illinois Medical Center in Chicago. He has also been a professor at the University of Bergen in Norway and a professor at Ankara, Turkey. Later, he became a consultant on drug abuse for the NATO forces in Europe. He has authored more than 50 scientific publications and approximately 20 books. Presently, he lectures at universities all over Europe and is a consultant for the University of Zurich. He is married, has four children, all of whom are at medical college, two at Heidelberg, Germany, and two in England. One of them is now an MD doing his intern work in England. I might state that if you have questions, if you want to write them out, we'll not take vocal questions, we'll take them only written out, and you can pass them, I was going to say to the aisle, but there is no aisle. So you just pass them to the front. And after his lecture, we'll have an opportunity to ask Dr. Wilder Smith questions. And with that, I present to you Dr. A. E. Wilder Smith from Einigen, Switzerland.
Well, I suppose you could say that's a sign if you're full of the Holy Ghost and faith, because you clap beforehand. Rather a dangerous thing to do, you know, when you don't know what's coming. Now, the subject that I've been requested to speak upon tonight, I was going to speak on Why Does God Allow It? But your pastor assured me that we have many young people here who are in college and having the usual difficulties of getting through college and the usual struggle with evolution and humanism and materialism. So I'm going to talk to you on evolution, theistic evolution, or creation tonight. Evolution, theistic evolution, or creation. And I'm going to read to you one paragraph from God's Word to start us off. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. He, the Word. All things were made through Him. There's another passage which says, in Him dwelleth all wisdom in bodily form. So wisdom, you know, is the opposite of chance. And if God made the world by Christ, as he here says, the Logos, then if you're going to impute chance to the all-knowing one, you're going to be in serious trouble, both scientifically and theologically, before very long. Without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life. And life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. That'll be enough for be always acceptable in thy sight, O our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the question is tonight, first of all, evolution, theistic evolution, or creation. The question is, has evolution occurred? Now, it obviously has occurred, in one sense of the word, in the etymological sense of the word. I mean, you're fairly young, aren't you? You're under 95, and I come within that category too, so you're still youngsters. Now, a few years ago, you were an egg. You were a zygote. Now, if you look at that zygote under the microscope, you'd be pardoned if you aren't a doctor or somebody who knows a bit about biology. You'd be pardoned for saying that that was a very primitive organism. It has one nucleus in it with 46 chromosomes, which you don't see easily, of course, and it looks like a protozoan. Looks like an amoeba, somewhat, if you don't know. And that one egg was formed by the fertilization of your mother's egg and your father's sperm. Now, if you just looked at that, it isn't as high a form of life as you are. Not in practice. It is in theory, if you look at the genes, and you look at the chromosomes, the 46 of them. But just to look at in gross morphology, it looks fairly simple, you know, pinhead. But it certainly isn't simple now. Look at the eyes, look at your hair, look at your nose, look at the face, the fact that you're a woman or a man. Very, very complicated indeed. So in that sense, you can say that from simple matter, well, relatively simple matter, from a zygote, you have arisen and entropy has decreased. Neg entropy has increased. Order has increased. So you can say in that sense of the word that evolution, if evolution means simply the increase of order, as it does from the point of view of etymology alone, if you say that, then certainly evolution has occurred. I won't argue with you on that basis. But when you come to say and tell me that evolution has occurred by chemistry alone, there the rub comes. If you say that chance chemistry or chance stochastic chemistry has done it alone, I'll take issue with you, and I will argue with you then. And I'll give you arguments, I think, which will stand up before any judges that know their science and have done their homework. There's no difficulty about it. If you say that evolution is the developing up of matter to living matter, dead matter to living matter, by chance or stochastic chemistry, which is what the Neo-Darwinian theory says. I said that on the radio this afternoon. I had an hour's interview on the radio, and somebody telephoned in post haste and said evolution theory doesn't say that. Well, it does. The first hypothesis on which evolution is faced, which is taught us in the college, this is what is taught us, is that life arose spontaneously once. Now, that's just what it means. Stochastic chemistry works spontaneously due to the chemical properties of matter, and if they combine together to form you by chance, same evolution, same chemistry as we have in test tubes in the lab, then I'll take issue with them. But if you say that ordinary chemistry, straightforward chemistry such as we use in the lab, makes your body run, I'll say, yes, it does. I'm thinking now by potassium ions going through certain synapses in my nerve endings and nervous tissue and creating potentials which carry the messages down. And if I hadn't eaten any grapefruit for a long time or got any potassium, I shouldn't be able to think. The dumb spirit would get hold of me and I would stand up here and not be able to open my mouth, you see. Well, now, that's chemistry. But if you say, listen here, friends, you've got to think carefully here, you know. If you say that that sort of chemistry alone did it, I'll take issue with you. I know that my body works on chemistry. I've just had a good evening meal, and I can feel it now working in my stomach, being digested to supply me with these potassium ions that I need to do my thinking. I had too good a meal, actually, and that's a very bad thing to do. Now, if you say to me that chemistry, are you with me? If you say to me that chemistry, which is programmed, did it, then I'll say, you're just on the ball. That's it. It's chemistry, which is programmed, that does it. And the 46 chromosomes in the zygote that made you provided the programming which was necessary to guide the chemistry in the right lines to produce your father's nose on your face, or your mother's eyes, or the fact that you're a man or a woman and not a crocodile or a frog. Because the language and the guiding in the crocodile, frog, cauliflower, or Brussels sprouts, they're all the same language. No, only the instructions in that language are different. And the instructions on a frog chromosome, are to make tadpoles and frogs. And the instructions on a crocodile are to make crocodiles. And so on, right up through the gorillas, the great apes, the chimps, and up to man. The mechanism is the same. It's program plus chemistry plus matter that does it. Now the question is then, the origin of life is really the origin of that program. The program for you, and the program for the cauliflower, and the program for the bee orchid. That's what the difficulty is. Where'd you get the program from? Now you know as well as I do, in a technological age, that programs do not arise spontaneously from chance. In order to make a program, what you do is make sure you leave nothing to chance. You invent your language, your Fortran, or whatever you want, and then you put onto that language the information which is a surprise effect, whereas chance is the thing that you would expect. So you neutralize chance when you make a program. That's just what I do when I think, and those old potassium ions get going in the brain. They cut out that which would normally occur and produce something which doesn't normally occur, and that we call a program. Now, the whole program for a man is holistic. Every bit of information is coordinated with the next bit of information. So you can't fiddle with it much, because if you do, you destroy the program. Now, when you come and tell me that the origin of life took place in matter and chemistry, I'll say, yes, but finish your sentence, please. And they say, what sentence? And I say, well, would you please finish that bit of information off? And they'll say, they look at you and say, we don't know what you're talking about. Well, I say, in that case, I have to instruct you. It's matter plus chemistry, plus, of course, time, plus the information, bits of information, millions of bits of information, which are necessary to program your ordinary chemistry. So we can say certainly of matter plus chemistry, which is governed by a concept. And that's just what I read out in the Gospel of John just now. In the beginning was the Word. You can read that, in the beginning was the concept. And the original concept was, of course, Jesus. That's what that word says that I've read out. Now, I wrote to Noam Chomsky recently, because I'm writing a book on the alternative to evolutionary theory. I've finished it. It's in Vienna now, being typed. And I asked him what he thought as a materialist about the origin of the information which makes a program. Do you know what that wise man wrote back and told me? He's not so silly as some of them, you know. He said this: the human mind and my mind cannot come to terms with the question of the origin of concept. And concept is, of course, a form of logos. And in the beginning was a concept which God worked out and made us. Now, if that's the case, the problem of life is the problem of the origin of concept. And the ordinary person, in fact, I know nobody who thinks otherwise on this point, the ordinary person just doesn't know where it comes from. Therefore, he says it arises by chance. But to tell me that chance produced non-chance is just simply tautology. It's nonsense. It's too thin a soup for a scientist to live on. He pines away if he has to flourish on stuff like that. He wants to know more. Now, of course, concept always comes from a mind. And mind is usually attached to intelligence. So you're tied up again with matter plus time plus energy plus intelligent concept, logos or telos, or whatever you like to call it, gives you life. Now, that's how I look at the origin of life. That's the basis I do it on. Now, what basis does evolution do it on? Evolution says this, and I'm going to give you 7 hypotheses. I don't know whether you people would mind. My thermostat is conking out. My jacket is preserving far too much calories, and I'm getting far too hot in the head. Would you, with all these lights on me, would you object? I know that this is being videotaped, but would you object? You wouldn't. Thank you very much. You see, you have to watch your machinery of the body, not abuse it, or it doesn't work as efficiently as it ought to. Now, the first hypothesis that I'm going to give you on evolutionary theory is this, and this is authentic, what I tell you now, and if you're going to help other people, and that's our main purpose, isn't it? Our main purpose is not to criticize other people and to win points on them and score off them and all that. I'm not interested in that. You usually lose your brother if you gain your point and are ruthless in doing it. And I want to win people, win the point if I can. But never mind if I don't. As long as I've won my brother or my opponent, I don't mind, you know. To win him is the most important thing. Same as when Christ was presented to me, he won me, and I trust I'm winning him. That's the main thing why I'm doing these things, not to score off other people. I regard that as a bad thing, to carry out a debate with professors and others, merely to show how, you know, smart I am. It's a bad way of doing things, it's an unchristian way of doing it too. Now listen, the first hypothesis that's put out for evolution is this, that non-living matter gave rise to living matter spontaneously. That is, that spontaneous generation occurred. That is, you leave your matter together with time and with energy, and out comes the formula for life. Life arises. That's the nature of spontaneous generation. Now, some people know have tried to prove that. Fox and Miller tried to do it. They took methane, and they took water, and they took ammonia, and they passed an electrical discharge through it, and they got out, lo and behold, a building block of life. They got out alanine, one of the building blocks of life, and some other amino acids too. Now, if that's the case, they said, if we can produce the bricks, the building blocks of which life consists, why can't we build the house by the same means? That is, if an avalanche goes down a hill and produces suitable sized stones to build a house, perhaps by going further down the hill and carrying the stones with it, you would build a house. Now, no, you might build a cave, you know, but they might claim that at a pinch would be a house. But never mind, I don't think it'd be a nice architecture anyway, do you? Our house that we live in, the body, is a reasonably good architecture, isn't it? You can look at us and say, well, there was a good architect behind it. Now listen, I want you to concentrate with me just for 2 minutes, because I don't want to lose much time on this, because I know many of you are not chemists. But the falsity of this argument should be clear to everybody. And yet, I have not seen a scientific journal publish an article on the falsity of this. Because if you send a scientific journal an article in on the falsity of this, they send it back and say that it's of no interest. That has happened on many, many, many occasions to my personal knowledge. Now, where does the falsity lie? The falsity lies in this. When you get out... Could you please put the machines on, the first one, slide number one.
What happens is this, that you do get out, I'll say it so that you can all hear it if you can't see it. You do get out your CH3, CH, NH2, COOH. Now that is a building block of life, no doubt about it. You also get some of the letters, right, turn it up because I believe they're trying to videotape this. You can also get out some of the building blocks of the genetic code, some of the letters in which the instructions are contained to build us on the chromosomes and on the genes. So they said, well, okay, if we've made some of the letters and we've made some of the building blocks, then why not the whole house, the whole body, the whole chromosomes, and the whole lot of genes? Well, the difficulty is this, ladies and gentlemen, that whenever you make a molecule of carbon containing carbon atoms, in which one carbon is sitting in the middle of a tetrahedron. That's what a carbon atom looks like, a tetrahedron. And the carbon atom sits in the center, and the valence is at the four points of the tetrahedron. You see the four isosceles triangles. Now, if you have carbon atom like that, with one asymmetric center in it, that means that there are four different substituents on each carbon atom. Now, you needn't understand this just now, but you can put it under your pillow when you get home and look at it before you go to sleep, and tomorrow you'll understand it perfectly if you sleep on it. Now, whenever you get a molecule produced like that with one asymmetric center in it, this is important, one asymmetric center in it, that is with four different substituents on it, that the molecule comes in two forms. One is a mirror image of the other. You see, it's like my hand. That's my left hand, and that's my right hand. The chemical analysis is the same, okay? You put me in a combustion tube and burn me up and see, the left hand will give the right hand exactly the same analysis. But if you try to superpose the hand like this, you see, you can't, because the thumbs always look out the corner, and there's no superposition possible, and congruency does not come out if you do that. But if you do it like that, you see they're perfect mirror images. One's a mirror image of the other. Now, the body, in order to make the proteins of life, needs only the left hand. It's better if the right hand is not there at all, because the body couples the left hand up to 1,000 times or more. Huge molecules coupled through the thumb and little finger, as it were. And they're all left-handed ones. And the left-handed hands fit into left-handed gloves of the same sort in the body, which we call the acceptor-receptor systems. Now you can see, ladies and gentlemen, just as well as I can, that if you have a system of molecules all in one left-handed hand type like that, which has to fit into a system of left-handed gloves, if you get some right-handed ones mixed up in it, it won't go in. Have you ever tried when it's dark to put a left-handed glove on a right hand? It's rather difficult. Similarly with a shoe. If it's in the dark and you get your right shoe on your left foot, you don't walk very far because it's rather painful. You see, the fit is not there. Now, in life, are you with me? In life, your shoes must have left-handed feet in left-handed shoes, and they must go in and out easily, not when you try to pull off a sort of a Wellington or a rubber shoe, and you've got the right one on the left, and you have to have a crane to get it pulled off again. That won't do. It must be easy in and out, and then they're capable of life. Now that's known as stereochemical fit. Now if you don't have the stereochemical fit, the DNA molecule won't work either, because the DNA requires 100% right hands, and therefore right-handed gloves, whereas all the proteins require left hands, left-handed gloves. If you mix them up, 50 left-handed and 50 right, all higgledy-piggledy, mixed up together, You can't get any fit at all, and those molecules are incapable of life. Therefore, we say in the technical terms, I've only made it clear because I know a lot of you haven't done your chemical homework, perhaps you will do later on. What I'm saying is this, that where you have 50% left and 50% right, there you get what is called in technical terms the racemic mixture, racemic mixture. And racemic life is to any biochemist who knows his job inconceivable. Now stochastic chemistry, chance chemistry, can only deliver racemic mixtures. How are you going to get out of a racemic mixture which is incapable of resolving itself, left-handed or right-handed, because every time a left-handed one's formed, a right-handed one's formed too, because the entropy status of the two is exactly the same. How are you going to get a living molecule out of that when it's a racemate? You can't do it. There have been big conferences on recently in Germany just on this project, because they don't like this to get into the school books. But they know very, very well themselves that this sooner or later is going to come out, and they'll have to resolve it. So they had 10 days in the atomic energy station in Jülich in Germany to try to find out how stochastic chemistry can be made to make the left-handed ones 100% and the right-handed ones 100%, left-handed building blocks and right-handed. And they came to the conclusion, are you with me? They came to the conclusion that you can't do it. Because the... No, this is not a question to be happy about. This is just simply a question of pure science. And don't get at anybody over these things. And be sure you know what you're talking about. Give rather a book if you're not quite sure yourself. You know, these people that can play the piano, and when you ask them to play, they can't. It's rather embarrassing. So the same thing happens with us on these matters. Just keep that in your mind. Ordinary chemistry, if anybody tells you that life is matter plus chemistry, you can say with perfect confidence, but with great humility, that is not possible. And if they say why, then you give the answer that they've given you. It can't be done. Okay? I put the book out on this, you know, I did my first PhD on this subject, and I wrestled with molecules which were optically active for 3 years, and I learnt a lot many, many years ago, which I can now apply to this question. There's no doubt about it, and everybody knows it. And if they try to cover it up, they do it with bad temper, and that's so regrettable, because it just simply hinders the spread of real knowledge. Now, the second thing is this, that this spontaneous generation, they say, occurred only once. That is, that life, which should occur spontaneously, but which will be racemic and therefore cannot live, they said it only occurs once. Well, let them have it. Let them argue. The argument is, you see, if you give a calf enough rope, it'll always hang itself without you having the bother of hanging it. So you let this go and say, well, good, life has happened spontaneously over once, only once, although you know it can't do, just let it go. Now, if that happened only once, there's a good reason for it. The reason for it is this, that the genetic code, which bears the information, like English, carries information, and you know the English convention so that you can understand it. If you say that this convention arose only once as proof of the fact that it did take place spontaneously only once, then I think that's quite a good thing to hold on to. Because, you see, I don't think that language and language convention on theory, on theoretical grounds, can take place to produce spontaneously a code. I don't think that it's within information theory to say that, because programs don't arise by chance.
And the genetic code is a language and a program. So we'll let that go and say, because all life contains the same code, from the blue-green alga through the amoeba up to the chimpanzee and to man and to the bee orchid, they all have the same code and the same genetic code. So they say, well, that's proof that only happened once. If it happened many times, each time it happened, the chance is that chance would have produced another type of code, you see. And as we've only got one type of code, therefore it didn't occur many times. The reason sound, I mean, if it's sound that codes can be formed and language conventions form that way. But think what you've done. Think what you've done, in which nobody thinks what he's done when he trots out that. You've said that the spontaneous generation occurred only once. Clear? Okay. If it occurred only once and is not repeatable, it's not scientific. Obviously, if you can't repeat an experiment, it's not scientific, it's metaphysical. Now, they say of the creationists, oh, creationism is religion. You see, you can't repeat creation. Because you can't repeat it, it's metaphysical and religious, therefore don't teach it in schools. But look what you've done. I don't believe that creationism is non-scientific. I believe it's repeatable. I believe that creation, especially the creation of life, is repeatable, and therefore scientific. But here, you see, they say that creationism is non-repeatable, therefore we do not take it seriously. This court case in Sacramento here worked on that basis. Therefore it's religion and should not be taught in schools. Well, if evolution proposes the second hypothesis, that you can't repeat spontaneous generation, it only occurred per definitionem once. Gentlemen, ladies, we're in the same boat. The creationists are metaphysical, and the evolutionists are metaphysical. So if they rock the boat, they tip themselves out as well as us. So where have you got to with that? Only to say, look here, boys, if you're going to differentiate against us by saying it's metaphysical, we're going to differentiate against you, because you certainly are metaphysical. You can't repeat it. I was in the lab years ago with my professor, struggling with polarimeters and with optical activity and resolution of optically active substances. You know, one day I did a reaction, and when I put the results in the polarimeter tube, put the polarized light through it, I got a huge rotation. Well, now, this is just impossible. Stochastic chemistry doesn't produce rotations like that. Stochastic chemistry always produces racemates which have no rotation. So I went barging up to my professor and said, come and have a squint at this. So he was a canny Scotsman, you know. A very canny man. And he had a way of saying very little. They're very short of words, the Scots, you know. But they have very expressive faces. And he just took one look at me and he said, okay, I'll come and have a look. So he came and had a look, and that was as large as life. Oh, and he said, Wilder, that's a job for the Nobel Prize, you know. That's just the cat's whisker. What are we going to do about it? Well, I said, I think it's just wonderful, don't you? Oh, yes, he said, it certainly is wonderful. But you know what I'd do first? I'd go and repeat it. See if you can do it again. So I said, okay, that's scientific. So I struggled for 3 weeks and repeated the whole bag of tricks. But this time I looked in, nothing. Absolutely nothing. So I went and told him, I can't repeat it. Oh, he said, you mustn't be put off like that. You go and repeat it 4 or 5 times, and then we'll believe something. So I went and repeated it 4 or 5 times, and these times, every time, I got nothing. Well, he said, it's clear now, isn't it? This is metaphysical, what you did the first time, because you can't repeat it. What you've got is a little bit of brucine in there. And brucine is optically active, and the impurity has given you your reading. And it was so. That was just it. But a thing you can't repeat, or per definitionem can't repeat, is certainly not science. So this second hypothesis of evolution is absolutely and totally non-scientific. Therefore, Karl Popper says, the whole theory is certainly metaphysical. And Karl Popper is an evolutionist. And when you say to him, why don't you change your views then, if you think evolution is just a good research program, but a metaphysical research program, he says, what am I to do? I've got no alternative. Well, you say the alternative is creation, you laugh at you because he's a convinced atheist. And he's a convinced atheist on the ground that the world is so bad that no good God could have made it. So, they just want a little book called Why Does God Allow It? And we've sold in Germany, in the first 3 years, 600,000 of those. Because that's the problem of all thinking people. Just that problem. You know, some are wicked and don't want to believe, but some would if they could and can't for fear of being intellectually dishonest. And I prefer those, you know, that are careful about being honest. If a Christian is honest in all his views and doesn't bring out cant at every opportunity, he'll get much further with his colleagues than if he just spouts out and throws Bible texts at them all day long. That doesn't help very much, although I believe, of course, that the Bible is the word of truth. Now, that's why the theory of evolution, for me, the two main hypotheses, are certainly outside science. Now, the third thing that the evolutionary theory says, I've got seven things, but I'll do them as quick as I can. The third hypothesis is this, that viruses, bacteria, plants, and animals are all genetically related and derived from one another. Now look. Just let's have a look. They say that frogs and amphibia have arisen from the same common stock as the lower species, and that the amphibia gave rise to the reptiles, and the reptiles to the birds and the mammals gave rise to the primates, and last of all, to the main primate, who is, of course, man. Now, just let's have a look and see what that means. And I'm going to try and help you look at this. If you take the genetic code, it is a system of information storage and retrieval. And it works on the basis somewhat like the Morse code. If you have SOS and you write it in the Morse code, you write it as dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. And there you've got SOS, the principle of peril, instead of being fixed to SOS of our alphabet, the principle of peril, SOS, is attached in this case to a reduced entropy system, which we call dot, 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 dash, 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 and dot, dot, dot. Now, dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, 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 doesn't look like SOS, does it? Doesn't look like it. But we've attached to that pattern the meaning of peril, something's wrong with me and I need help. Now, if you take the dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, 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 and put them on a shoelace in the form of three knots, three double knots, and three knots, and I hang up the shoelace to you, you can see that that means SOS, can't you? Perfectly easy. Now, I can read that in the dark. I can run my fingers over it, and I say dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. Uh-huh. Peril's in the offing somewhere. Or I can look at it with my eyes. I can look at it with my eyes and say, aha, yes, that means peril. Now, the genetic code works just on that basis. It has four letters, five if you count uracil for the RNA. It has four letters, and the various sequences decide the meaning, like APE. That is the sequence. A-P-E means ape, and P-E-A means pea, you know, sweet peas that grow in the garden. Now, that's only made, this code, is only made by changing the sequences. D-A-N, Dan, a boy's name. A-N-D, a conjunction. Same letters, but different sequence. And you could write up with the Morse code on a shoelace, if it was long enough, you could write up all of Goethe's Faust. No difficulty at all. And you take the shoelace in your hand and feel it down, you'd read Röslein, 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 Rot, Röslein auf der Heide of Goethe, you see. A wonderful way of writing, but it's a way of writing, a code. Now the genetic code works by four letters, read in triplets of three or codons, which contain the plain chemical instructions to build you. And they're held on two shoelaces, on two spirals of phosphate and deoxyribose. Perfectly simple, perfectly like a book, and yet very, very, very complicated, because they replicate themselves by dividing down the middle and then building up by complementarity the other side. One side goes into one cell and one side goes into the other cell of this ladder, and then the ladder becomes double again by complementarity, and you've got it reproduced. Now look, the thing is this, that this system of information storage and retrieval is rather to be compared, if you like, to a cassette or an audio tape or a videotape, if you like. That is, you can put in information in a code form. In the case of the audio tape, it's in magnetic fields on the iron of the tape, isn't it? Or in videotape too, but a bit more complicated. Now, look, I've got here a tape, and the tape is an audio tape and contains some music of Mozart. Okay? Now, the music of Mozart is very, very well integrated, as you know. Especially when you're tired and come home rattled from the day and you say to your dear wife, who's a musician, play me a piece of Mozart and my spirit will be quietened, like Saul did, you know, once in the Old Testament. Now, you've got on the other side another tape, same sort of tape, but with a different program on it. The first program was the program of Mozart, held in magnetic fields. The second tape that you've got is a videotape or an audio tape of, say, a piece of Beethoven. Nice piece of Beethoven. You can't mix the two. You see, they're two species of music, both very beautiful, but both a species of music, and what we call a holistic species. If you mix up the score of a piece of Mozart and the score of a piece of Beethoven, you get in a serious mess. You've got to treat the whole piece of music for each instrument as a piece of a whole. Everything is done as a piece of the whole. Genetic code is just like that. Now, a frog may look like Mozart's music. You needn't connect me with Mozart and frogs, but I'm just doing this for the sake of argument. And say the piece of Beethoven is like a salamander, just to get them fairly near one another. Now what the problem is this. Are you with me? This is hard. The problem is this. How am I going to change? How am I going to evolve, or cause to evolve, the genetic code of a frog into a salamander or into a reptile? A reptile would be a third tape, you see, audio tape. How am I going to do it? Well, you think you've got the tape of Mozart, you've got your tape of Beethoven, how would you do it? Change one into the other. That is, do evolution on these two. I'm not saying Mozart's higher than Beethoven, or Beethoven's higher than Mozart, but just change one into the other for sake of argument. How would you do it? Well, Darwinism says you can do it. You see, they say that you can take the tape, or the genetic code, of one species, and by shooting at it with point mutations, you can change it into the tape of another. What do you think of that? Well, you know, it makes the statesman think about that. So the information engineers have been working on this lately, and they've encountered an enormous amount of opposition. Because they've shown that if you set up the information of a tape on a computer, say, for our argument tonight, some Mozart music, you set that up on a computer, and you set up then the tape of Beethoven on a computer, and then you start just to fire at random at the Mozart tape. Well, do you know what they found? I expect you guessed. That you reduce the tape after the first 3 or 4, 5, 6, 7 or 8 alterations. You can make alterations, and they'll stand. But after you do it too much, the whole tape is reduced to informational noise and means nothing whatsoever. It just reduces everything to noise. But you can't make it change one tape into another because the program is holistic. Now, this is a fact of information theory. And it was taken over recently, some time ago, to the Wistar Institute here in Philadelphia, on the other side, and demonstrated to the biologists, because this is the problem of evolution, that one species changes into another by chance mutations, point mutations. What you're trying to say is that by chance mutations, one tape, one genetic code, will change into another, the genetic code of another species. And it was demonstrated to Waddington, who was one of the chief evolutionists, and he watched it for a long time, hours. When he was ready and seen it all, they asked him what he thought. Because this disproved everything, that one species changed into another. And he said, gentlemen, and got up and turned his back. He said, I'm not interested further in your computers. Now, that's one way of treating knowledge, turn your back on it. But if you do that, you're not going to profit from a new field of endeavor. Now, engineering, information engineers are fully aware of this, and they say, we mustn't do that, because here we've got a classical example of our science, which is the storage and retrieval of information. And if you've got a system of storage and retrieval of information set up in a code or a language, by point mutations you can't change it into another holistic series. It just won't work. You reduce both to noise, and then you've got to start again. So the idea that a cow might change into another mammal, or a whale might change into another mammal, is equivalent to trying to change Mozart into Beethoven by chance mutations, point mutations. You can't. And people know it today. And therefore they're getting wild. Now, that's a bad way if somebody brings you new knowledge that you answer by getting nasty. It shouldn't be done among academically minded people. They should be willing to take truth for the truth's sake, I included. I include myself in that. And if I can't, if I get ratty about these things, I know that I'm doing it to protect myself. And that, of course, is a bad means to get further knowledge. Now, that's the third hypothesis of evolution, that one species changes into another. The information theory says no. Now, there's one thing I ought to say on this. Well, I'll do it when I come to the fossils. The fourth one is this. Protozoa gave rise to metazoa. Now, the protozoans are the one-celled organisms, and the metazoan includes us, we're the mini-celled organisms. Okay? No difficulty. There's some evidence for this, not very much, but you know what a slime mold is, Myxomycetes? Well, they look like an amoeba. But there comes a time when they coalesce, and all the cytoplasm runs together, and you get a big slime. And in that slime, there are lots and lots and lots of nuclei. Now, they say that's an example of evolution taking place from a single-celled organism to a multi-celled organism. Well, okay, if you like. But you look at it like this. You look at the genetic code of the original slime mold, and you look at the genetic code of the colony. You know, they're both the same. If you look at the genetic code of the tadpole, It's the same, you know, as the genetic code. Genetic code of the frog. Now, you see, if you didn't know, and you looked at a tadpole, if you didn't know, you might think it was some sort of a fish. But if you look at the genetic, if you look at the frog, you say, well, that is an amphibian. But if you look at the genetic code of birth, you know there's been no evolution from a tadpole to a frog, because the genetic code's the same. So it's a very dangerous thing to use what we call gross morphology. That is the gross anatomy of an organism to decide its evolutionary status. You see, if you look at a thylacine wolf, which is a mammalian wolf, and you look at a mammalian wolf, such as you have the timber wolf out here, if you look at the two of them, although they're so far apart, according to the evolutionists, they look in gross morphology remarkably like one another. Of course, they have a pouch, the marsupials, and the mammals have a placenta, but outwardly speaking, with respect to their skeleton and structure, they're remarkably alike. What would tell you is you've looked at the program, looked at the genes, then you'd know. Now, that's the fourth point that I want to take to you. There's no evidence for real evolution taking place from one species to another, even in the Myxomycetes that I mentioned. Now, the fifth one, and I'm almost at an end here, ladies and gentlemen, is this. The fifth one is that the various invertebrates are all related to one another. The octopus, the squid, the spider, the crab, the flies are all interrelated. There's very little evidence for that. So we'll let that one go. The sixth is the sixth assumption that invertebrates gave rise to vertebrates. Experimental evidence for that is none. Now, the seventh, ladies and gentlemen, is within the vertebrates, the fish, the amphibia, the reptiles, the birds and the mammals, and man, there is a common ancestral stock. Now, that's known as the general theory of evolution, and the common way of proving that, as they say, is to use embryology. Now, I can't go into embryology tonight, I haven't got time. But the idea of the recapitulation theory of Haeckel has long since been shot to pieces. Nobody in the know in Europe today teaches that. The other one is the idea of fossils. What are we going to say about the fossils, the dinosaurs and all these other things that are going? Now, I want to give you some evidence of the fossils on seven being right or wrong. The hypothesis number seven, which is my last one, being right or wrong. They may mimic one another, but do they come from one another? Now, I'm going to read out to you a letter which the head of department of paleontology in the British Museum wrote to his American colleague, Sutherland, here in America. Patterson, who is the head in London, the British Museum, paleontologist, he's been having a lot of trouble lately. He is an evolutionist, and he has in his museum, the British Museum, thousands and thousands of family trees and evolutionary exhibits. And these wonderful exhibits cost a lot of money. And England is bankrupt. Very, very influential person in England, Sir Karl Popper, because he's a scientific philosopher. He says that not one of these hypotheses, such as I've taught you tonight, are provable, verifiable, or falsifiable. And therefore the whole business is metaphysical. And that the teaching of evolution is metaphysical and should be taught as such and not as a scientific fact. Well, now, Patterson and company have been using their money for teaching a metaphysical hypothesis as a fact with public monies, which of course is a very dangerous thing to do, not only in America, but also in England. Now, he wrote this letter to his American colleague, Sutherland, and this is it. Gould, who's been lost in the news here lately, and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say that there are no transitional fossils. Oh. As a paleontologist myself, I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil, transitional fossil, between one species and the next, for which one could make a single watertight argument. This is a paleontologist speaking, an evolutionist. You've got to defend his position now, because they're investigating him. Then he says his Archaeopteryx, you know, that bird, fossil bird with the teeth in its beak. Is Archaeopteryx the ancestor of all birds? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. There is no way of answering this question. It's easy enough to make up stories of how one form gave rise to another and to find reasons why the stages should be favored by natural selection. But such stories are just not part of real science. There is no such way of putting them to the test, and therefore they're not part of science. Now, when a man owns up to that, who's a paleontologist, and he says there's not one case in the British Museum or anywhere else that shows that gross morphology in the fossils show that transition of one species to another has taken place. Not one. He says, perhaps Archaeopteryx, but we're not sure of that. Well, let's deal with Archaeopteryx then. Archaeopteryx has recently been found in America geologically quite a deal younger than the modern birds. That is, the modern birds were there first, and then came Archaeopteryx. Now, it's rather difficult to be the ancestor of your grandson, you see. It's a father for your grandson to be your ancestor. You can't do it that way. It just doesn't work. So if Archaeopteryx really is younger, and I'm pretty sure that geologically they've got quite good evidence for this, then of course there was no change of Archaeopteryx into a bird from a reptile and up to the modern birds via Archaeopteryx. Now, those will be the details that I wanted to speak to you about. Now, it's 9:15. How long do you usually sit at my feet? Well, I'll just give you one or two other little tidbits and show you the difficulty.